Welcome to episode number 25 of the Circles Off podcast. I'm Rob Pizzola, joined by Johnny from BetStamp. And this week, a very special guest. We're going to welcome in another professional sports bettor. Unfortunately for those listening right now, they don't get to see the beautiful mural behind pro sports bettor Mike Craig of the Roberto Clemente Bridge, which he painted all by himself. Absolutely stunning in the background there. Mike, how are things going?
Going well. I am quite the painter. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I've known Mike for years now from the MIT Sloan Sports Betting or Sports Analytics Conference in Boston. And we met there. And when we first interacted, had a lot of mutual friends. So we kind of hit it off and had some great drinking nights just in general. And Mike doesn't do a whole lot of media. So thought this would be a great opportunity to showcase another bettor that's out there. So Mike, let's get right into it and just let people know a bit of your background, how you got started in betting. Basically, what's your background story?
So I have a math degree and a chemical engineering degree from Penn State. So I've always been pretty good with numbers. In high school, I was always interested in everything. I actually used to cut out the lines from the USA Today and make a bunch of copies, and I would hand out parlay cards. I went to a big high school, so I called it the pick five. You had to pick five games. I paid you 20-1. I think in 4 years, I think five people won that. So I was always interested in it. I realized it was a very difficult thing. Coming out of college, I had dabbled in betting in college. I made my first deposit overseas, just like a couple hundred dollars, lost it pretty quickly. Bet with a couple of local guys at college and didn't ever have any success. Didn't lose very much because I wasn't betting very much at the time. But coming out of school, I got a job and, you know, I was still very into it. I'm a very competitive person. I know you've talked about that, Rob, before, where I think inherently, like, a lot of professional sports bettors are extremely competitive people. You get out of college, you're not playing sports anymore. Not that I was playing them in college, but it's sort of natural to get into something that challenges you, and the challenge to win becomes a thing. And I never got into this to make money. I just enjoyed it. I like figuring things out. But started getting into Dr. Bob, bought his picks, was reading his free analysis, was buying his picks. And I was really into like the taking advantage of bonuses and things like that online. So you had like you had Bodog, you had sportsbook.com, you had Bet Jamaica. I mean, even Pinnacle was giving out bonuses at that point, WWTS, the Greek, Carib, all these places. So I sort of started with a bankroll. I mentioned this on a different podcast, on Ed Feng's podcast, that my wife had gotten a bonus check at one point and she just gave it to me to put it into an account and kind of let me run with it. So I was doing, I don't have an interesting story, like I bet $200,000 on teasers or I put my net worth on the Lakers to win the title or anything. I was just systematically attempting to build this as if it were a larger bankroll, I guess. So doing a lot of the bonus thing, Dr. Bob thing. So with the bonuses, I actually got to the point where I had like 18, I think I had 18 people under me, and I was probably making like $1,000 to $1,500 a week. I had just like hired one, not hired, but I was paying one of my friends to like call in and redeem all these bonuses. So I did a pretty good job of building my bankroll. I went from 5,000, I think I got that up. It was right around $100,000 when the Unlawful Internet Gaming Act hit, and that sort of put a halt on everything. So I took that money and I invested into some other things. I bought a couple of condos to rent out, and I started a ticket resale business. Then a couple of years later, I was always still interested in it, and people started messaging me like about, someone messaged me about KenPom, and I started looking into KenPom, and I put my own spin on it, and I sort of made his numbers into something I thought was better than what he was doing for projections. And I knew enough, I had never originated before, but I knew enough about what went into making a good bet and what constituted a good bet to know that very quickly that I had something that I could at least beat openers with at the time. And, you know, openers, $500 at Chris at the time. So I had most of my money tied up. At that point, I had a couple of kids too. So I ended up taking out a home equity line of credit. I sent that over to Chris. I remember being at like a grocery store at a Western Union, like peeling off $100 bills to send to Costa Rica. That's how it used to be, which you probably don't know much about, but that's how it used to be. But sent money over there and kind of just restarted the whole thing with building the bankroll. Got in, read Basketball and Paper, which, like I said, I never had originated, and I thought that I was capable, but I didn't really know how to start. And once I read that book, it kind of gave me a framework to build off. So immediately I went into WNBA. I wanted to do like a small league, and like the first model I built just in like Excel, it was relatively simple. And I think it back tested it like 66% against the closing line or 68%. So I knew that I had something there, and I guess I just slowly kept adding new things to my repertoire. And you know, you keep learning, and you know, I think we'll talk about it later, but I eventually worked with the Raz, I worked with Sports Insights, met a bunch of other people, but that's kind of the story of how I got started.
It's really fascinating. There's like so much to unpack there, because you kind of like started in a ways as a bookmaker with the parlay cards, right? Even though it was like, you know, little league type of stuff or whatever, and then moving into like the bonus hunting portion, and then moving into like, I'm going to start originating. And I mean, one thing that's very fascinating about the whole story is obviously taking out a line of credit to be able to bet and deposit into other books, and getting your wife's bonus from her day job and putting that towards betting. Like, obviously at some point you reach a degree of confidence where you're saying, I have something here. And you talk a little bit about closing line value. Like, how do you get to the point of being a novice bettor, moving on into like an experienced bettor, where one, you do understand that closing line value is important, but two, being able to say, I'm ready to take on some major risk in order to be able to get down?
I think, you know, when you're doing the bonus stuff, you're having to, or, you know, one of the things I would do is Pinnacle, if you put in $5,000, they would give you $5,500 to play with. Not a big bonus by any stretch, no referrals or anything. But then like your smaller books, your Bodogs, your Caribs, your whatever, they're giving you bigger bet. Jamaica had pretty big bonuses, I think, sometimes. Greek actually had decent bonuses sometimes too. But anyways, what I would do with Pinnacle, I would sign up for an account under someone's name and have $5,500 in there. I would find a line that Pinnacle differed on, and I didn't know anything about a Pinnacle lean at the time. So I would find something where I could just lose all of the accounts at once, just because I want to cycle the money on to the next account and keep the bonus money rolling. So you learn a lot there, because you figure out that you never win at Pinnacle. And so it's like, why am I always losing at Pinnacle? And the story is, you should be betting the lines that are wrong at these other places rather than attempting maybe not a true middle, but maybe a push win situation or something, just to roll the money over. So the money always came out of Pinnacle, went into the smaller accounts. So you kind of get a sense of, you know, this book's sharper than the other. And then, you know, with all the names I had underneath me, I was giving anybody whose name was underneath me, I would give them a cut, of course, of what came through. And then a lot of those people, since we were doing Dr. Bob at the time, and that was, Dr. Bob was, had a couple of really, really good years back then. So a lot of those people would just take the money they made, and I'd say, hey, I'll just play Dr. Bob's stuff for you. So I was playing pretty big numbers. You know, I'm playing pretty sizable amounts at the time. Like maybe like 4,000 or 5,000 a game between all the people I had. But you sort of recognize the same types of thing with Dr. Bob. You know, when the line moves his way, it wins more often than not. And when he sees some resistance, it could be trouble, or it's a 50-50 play. And I think experience is a big thing. And, you know, a lot of people, I hear all these finance people want to get in this. I say, that's fine, but I just think there's a level of doing this and being on the ground floor and placing the bets and seeing how the market reacts that is a very important thing for, I think, a lot of the people we know. I think it's just experience building and seeing, basically analyzing markets and seeing how the market reacts to your bets that you're placing. So I don't know if that necessarily answered the question, but I guess when you start handicapping and originating, you use all these experience, you draw from these previous experiences where you know what constituted a good bet. And I knew I knew when I sent money to Costa Rica, I knew that I was likely going to win. Not with 100% certainty, but I knew that the odds were very much in my favor.
Yeah, that's an awesome story, Mike. I think I had a very similar thing happen to me just, years later, in a sense that, you know, everyone learns slowly the lesson that you don't beat the sharp books. If you're going to play and then play back, or if you have something that's a full arb or a middle opportunity, more often than not, you are losing at Pinnacle. You are losing at Chris, and you're going to win on, you know, X square book. So no matter how many times you tell people that, they don't get it until you actually do it yourself and you realize, how do I have to keep depositing into Pinnacle every single time with everything? And my other books, they're flush, right? And then you start to realize, oh, these other books will limit you if you win and Pinnacle won't. So, you know, you just kind of come to the realization that there is something here, you know. And then in terms of the closing line stuff you're mentioning, I think that's, you know, you're 100% spot on, in a sense that when it ties in all together, right? When you're beating Pinnacle, you can beat the closing line, then you're going to win. When you're able to bet more is when you're going to lose. And that's when you have market resistance. So a good rule of thumb for anyone out there listening who maybe is starting out or doesn't have a huge bankroll is, I would say, you know, if you're going to look for a sports book to fund, then probably you're going to want to avoid funding the sharper books and tying up some of your money there. Because at the end of the day, even though they have some of the best prices, if they do have the best price in the market, it's likely not something you want to bet. And I don't know about you, Mike, would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that. And I retaught myself that lesson because I work with one partner specifically. And then of course we have a network of people that we work with beyond that, but I have one partner. And one of the ways we built our bankroll was baseball team totals. I made a sheet that projected those very accurately. And at first we were just taking all these off-screen books and we would try to middle, like one place would have four and Pinnacle would have 4.5 and it'd be 5 cents juice each way, which is a great middle. But we would lose at Pinnacle literally every single time. And we finally got to the point where we're like, this is just idiotic. It didn't take long, but we got to the point where we're like, we're just going to bet as much as we can on the wrong way, the non-Pinnacle books, which was always the under, almost always the under. And so, yeah, I totally agree with that. And I did have to reteach myself that lesson a couple of years after the totals, after I started with Chris and the totals and everything.
Mike, out of curiosity, I mean, I'm in my mid-30s. I didn't really start seriously betting till I was in my late 20s. I'm curious, back in the day, in terms of Pinnacle versus the other shops, was everyone still mirroring Pinnacle as close as they could at the time? Or is that like a lesson that the sports books have learned over the last decade of, well, these are really sharp books, we're just going to copy these lines type of thing?
I don't know if I was aware enough to answer that with 100% certainty, but I think it eventually trended that way. I think people were still copying Chris and Chris was still originating, but right. Pinnacle was definitely considered, like, I don't think you would consider Pinnacle the sharpest book in everything right now.
No,
I would definitely say that. But back then, I think pretty much everyone would have said Pinnacle was the sharpest. And yeah, I think you did see books trending towards what Pinnacle had to say, at least the ones that were reputable.
Right. I'm just very interested in that, because obviously I don't want to say bookmaking is easy nowadays, but it sort of is, right? Because everybody has a few sharp shops that they can just essentially copy, cater to their player base a little bit more by maybe shading the line towards what they think that the square recreational base is going to bet. And I wonder like how far back we have to go to a time where everybody was just kind of running their own numbers rather than, you know, just copying everybody else. And that's that predates me betting, but I was wondering if it predated you as well.
There were still books. There were books when I was starting, and they would limit you quickly, but the SIA types,
right.
I don't know when SIA came about. It wasn't quite that early, I don't think, but there was like 9.com, and they had, Bodog was very square. There was a couple other ones. I don't remember them, but you could literally make a living just betting underdogs and unders on those sites. But again, they would cut you off pretty quickly. But I think if you mixed things in, you'd be a little better off. But yeah, certainly you're less reputable, and the books that catered to squares were, I mean, it was, I wish I could go back now.
I get it. You mentioned Dr. Bob, Ken Pom as being good sources back in the day, you eventually building off of Ken Pom. I know that when I was coming up, I was kind of like looking for sources like that, basically someone else to do the work for me where I could piggyback off of that. And I just wonder how much of what you do now is actually your own stuff versus how much you're still betting stuff that isn't yours or looking at maybe other, whether it's private or publicly available information that you can piggyback off of.
I mean, I don't like scour Twitter for picks or anything. It's mostly my stuff, I'd say. I mean, I get some soccer stuff. Like my brother does MLS soccer. This has been his worst year he's ever had. But that's historically been very good. I get soccer from a couple other people. The golf, NASCAR type stuff. Every once in a while, like one of the guys you work with would be like, oh, you know, this guy's on this or this guy's on this, pretty heavy. So stuff like that. A lot of originators don't like to bet. They don't like to bet anything that isn't their own. So if it's college football or college basketball or something that I handicap on my own, I would want to filter it and say, I don't want to blindly bet this, but stuff like NASCAR or soccer, I don't know. I just know that it's won in the past, and I know that I respect this person, so I will play it blindly. There's plenty of things I'll play blindly. I'd play your hockey blindly. I don't know anything about hockey.
It's not up for sale or not up for sharing, but yes.
Mike, question for you here. I think when you mentioned, you know, a lot of people who originate don't like to play other people's stuff. I think another thing that people who originate make a mistake in doing is that they always play whatever line is good to their number. So if you make a game, you know, you're like, this is good to -152, then any originator, regardless of market, in a lot of cases make the mistake. A lot of them make the mistake and say, yeah, I'm going to play this to -152. So I know you, and we've had multiple discussions in person, and you're a really sharp guy. Do you play to your reserve price, or is it a mix between playing to the reserve price but also taking into account like, hey, these numbers might be better here, so let me still try to scrape around and find good numbers?
It would depend on the situation. There'd be a lot of cases where I'm not the type who's, I don't have an infinite bankroll, so I'm not trying to bet $20,000 on anything. Pretty much anything. So for the most part, I can fill what I need before I get to the point where I say, oh, I need to go exactly to the number, to my threshold or whatever. So I can usually fill it to where that's not an issue. There is smaller stuff where it's kind of like, yeah, I would bet it completely to that level. I might even go above that level if I start to see like the market agreeing with me. I might even like if I say I want to bet over 150 or less in a college hoops game, and I bet it to 150, and I see it go start moving a little more, I might, and I'm not filled, I might add a little bit more onto that just because I'm seeing some agreeance from someone else sharp.
Got it. So you started obviously, you know, before Rob or I started betting, and you mentioned a few of the sports books that were big back in the day. I got to imagine it was pretty easy back then, like you mentioned, finding easy arbitrage plays, finding easy middles between even just Pinnacle and these recreational books. I wanted to ask you, a lot of people say, hey, wow, that was the golden age. Now it's kind of hard to win. Do you agree with that? Or, you know, is it still easy to win right now? How have you found it? Obviously, it's easier, but what are your thoughts on that?
I didn't know enough. So back when I started, like I probably started in 2002 or three. I didn't know enough of the tricks to do all this stuff at the time. So, I mean, I wish I could go back and do a little more of that. But I think the markets get sharper every day. I definitely think you see the major markets, especially. I would think NHL has gotten much sharper. I wouldn't know. I think from talking to people I know, baseball has gotten much sharper. Even college football, I can see there's not as much that's off. And you have to bet earlier now too. Like you used to have, like Bet Jamaica used to have, I think they had 5 cent Fridays from like 5 to 6 Eastern or something. So you could wait till Friday and bet a bunch of totals, and they hadn't moved all week, or they hadn't moved significantly all week. Nowadays, it's when something is off early in a major market, college football, whatever, it's sort of a rush to get that number. And it's like, it's going to go on Monday morning when the off screens populate, and you just don't quite have as much time. So I think that's a challenge that you didn't have in the past, and the numbers are sharper. So I think everything's gotten harder in general though.
So Mike, has that changed your betting style drastically? Because like I imagine when you started betting in the early 2000s, just like everyone else who starts their venture into betting, it's probably mostly major markets, like sides and totals on games, before they kind of get into other stuff. I think what I'm particularly noticing, especially amongst the professional bettors nowadays, is there's much more of a willingness to attack different markets, whether that's like alternate lines, team totals, props. Have you naturally noticed yourself gravitating towards those alternate markets as well?
Yeah, I do a lot with, I've always been good with like scoring distributions. So I've always been good with team totals and quarters, half times. So I've always actually preferred that. Well, since I started figuring out what I was doing, I'd say in 2012, I'd say I figured out college football. It took me a couple of years, but I'd say I figured it out then. I'd say hoops, I figured out in 2008 or 9. So those are my two main things that I do. There's some NFL things I do that's all that off-market type of stuff. But I think, you know, with team totals, it didn't used to be like, oh, I can get down multiple thousands of dollars on this. It used to be not all that widely available. Now, like last week, there was two games where I kind of leaned with a side. I leaned with Rutgers and under, which both hit. So like, I didn't like either enough to play, but then in your head, you're like, well, if those are my leans, then I should hit Syracuse team total under if I like the game under and the other side. And those both won. I also like Florida International and over, which both lost, but that would have put me on Florida International over team total.
We can edit that one out so that you are only the one.
I don't want to sound like I'm only talking about the wins. But yeah, so team totals can be a better bet, I think. And a lot of times you're laying 115 instead of 110, but there's a bigger edge with it. And those tend to be shaded upwards very slightly, not significantly, but a lot of times in football, you'll see the key numbers. You'll see 17.5, 21.5. You won't see 16.5s as much, or you'll see the key numbers shaded upwards. So inherently there's going to be a little bit of a edge on under to things.
How about venturing into other sports that are maybe not as common as well? Because you sound, I actually don't know what you bet on, Mike, just in general, but from the sounds of things, and especially when we talk in person, you're obviously a big football bettor, especially college football. And I know you do some college basketball as well. Have you noticed that over the years, One with, like, assuming that your edge has been reducing over the years, which it does sound like in those major markets, that you've been branching out into maybe some less popular sports, like WNBA seems to be very popular nowadays. I know you mentioned soccer, which I'd like to talk to you about a little bit more, but maybe stuff that's just a little bit more obscure.
Well, WNBA is one of the first things I like truly built. So I've been doing that for a long time, and that's gotten a lot sharper. It used to be a joke way back. I think I mentioned like the first model I make is hitting like 68-67% against closing lines on toes. I mean, it's ridiculous how easy it used to be. The other thing is now I'm better with numbers and I'm better with matchups, and I'm less good at scouring Twitter and injury reports to see who's in and out. And in WNBA, they make way more money overseas than they do playing in the WNBA. So the challenge I've seen personally is staying on top of who's in and out of games. It's now that FanDuel actually has fantasy contests for WNBA, I actually usually just look there because they seem to have pretty good information. But I got off topic there for a second, but yeah, if it's something where a line's, if I'm going to the casino, I'll like throw numbers together for like lacrosse or something, and I feel like it should be easy enough for me to just throw it into a silly or a bit like Big Three basketball. I actually didn't do well in Big Three basketball this year, but like last year I did really, really well in Big Three basketball, and you can't bet very much, but you know, you hit four or five accounts and hit a Pennsylvania sportsbook or two, and you've got a decent piece there. So, just little stuff and simple models, nothing too time consuming, just something to throw out there to generate a little bit of volume. And I used to be a big, like when the edges were bigger, I used to be a huge volume bettor. Like I had tons of bets every week. I would bet like first day of college hoops, I'd have 40 or 50 bets on sides and totals, and college football first couple of weeks, 25, 35 bets a weekend between side, just straight sides and totals. Now I'm lucky to get, like, I actually bet 11 totals this week in college football and a couple of sides. But that's, I consider that like a kind of a big week. I usually don't have that many plays nowadays, and it is early in the season, so I think there's more subjectiveness that goes into some of that. So early season, I would expect a little more, but like as we get into the season, I'd expect maybe 6 or 7 plays a week, as opposed to the huge cards on every Saturday in football. And then in basketball, I mean, every Saturday I'd have 25 plays, and now it's like 6 or 7 maybe. So
Mike, I wanted to ask you, so how are you, obviously you're betting a lot of sports, smaller market stuff, bunch of different accounts, like how are you managing all this? Is it technology based, manual? Like how are you going through, you know, scrubbing through all these sites, seeing what lines are available, keeping balances in check? Like it's obviously a tough process.
Well, I'm mostly doing the originating, so my partner, I'll just pull lines from a site and try to come up with some plays, and I'll just send it to him and I'll say, hey, look for this, and he'll go out and bet it wherever he can. So that's kind of a general process. I guess I used to be semi computer savvy, but nowadays, like I'm past my prime with that kind of thing. Like it's a lot of what we do is still manual. A lot of the accounts we get, people are like, don't use robots on this. So it's like manually hiding your IP address in whatever city and betting as much as you can into as many accounts as you can when you find something good.
We don't have Mike's partner with us today, but Mike's partner does use BetStamp as well, which he's told me in person. For anyone who's shopping major markets, absolutely need to use BetStamp. That's how we get the plugs in, Mike. We'll keep going. I'm just very interested in a lot of what you've had to say so far. But one of the things, and maybe this isn't necessarily your line in your partnership, but I know if a guy is betting lacrosse into some accounts that I'm giving him, it's very likely that if I'm the agent, I'm going to say, I'm done with this guy type of thing, right? And venturing out into these different markets and smaller limits and things of that nature, do you find it a battle or a struggle to be able to get enough down and to keep accounts?
Well, I think one of the things I always had going for me was the volume, because I look like a total maniac when I'm betting. I'm
true.
Filling up the entire credit line. And a lot of these old school bookies think there's no way in hell this guy is going to win in the long run. And if we have a good week, I'll put a bunch of NFL in just to, like, please let me keep this account for a week. Let me give you a little bit back on NFL or break even better. It becomes a challenge, and I really think now with the books in PA, that's really what saved me. Like last year, I didn't have a good set of accounts last year to work with, and luckily with I think there's about 12 or 13 sites now in PA, so I was able to spread that money around enough. And I think if you don't, I don't know this for a fact, but like a lot of times you'll submit a bet on one of these sites and they'll say, oh, the limit's $440. I'll go in and I'll bet it for like $385 to win $350. I don't know if like betting max every time makes you stick out. So I that's something I do that I don't know if it helps or not. But, and, you know, eventually I think you end up, if you know what you're doing, you end up getting, and nobody kicks you out because they don't want the stigma attached with, oh, we kick people out. Everybody limits you to less than $10 to bet. So,
which is essentially kicking you out though, because it's not worth your time.
Exactly. I haven't had too much trouble. I still have like three or four places in Pennsylvania that do all right for me. And then it's usually from guys that help you out, you get like a football season replenishment of accounts. So, yeah, I have some more accounts to work with right now, and we'll see how long it lasts. But you're right. Like I know I had a couple of runs last year on some NFL stuff, like team totals and quarters and stuff. And you're mixing in like some NFL and college too. But funny thing is, it always seems if you crush somebody over 3 weeks and they take your account away, I feel like you always lose that next week. Like they'd be better off just like rolling with the punches. And like law of averages, at some point I'm not going to hit 80% on this stuff. But they end up taking the accounts away. I think it's just a matter of having enough people that are looking out for you and trying to help you get accounts. So that's.
Yep. I like the idea of not betting to the limits. It's not something that I've personally ever done, and I wonder if it even matters or not, but I think you do try a bunch of, like, if you're consistently winning at betting and you want to kind of fly under the radar, there's all these tips and tricks that you can try. Obviously, betting NFL 10 minutes before post on Sunday is the easiest way to go about it, because no one that wins does that. So naturally, you're probably able to keep that account for a lot longer. I know personally in the past, I've only bet overs into specific accounts that I think are, I'm at risk of losing. So if I was playing MLB strikeout props, for example, I would only play my over edges into the Square recreational books, because then it looks like, well, this guy's playing seven overs a day on pitcher strikeouts. You know, what's he doing? And maybe fly under the radar a little bit more. But the limits one is interesting. It's something that I will probably try going forwards just to see if there's any longevity there. But I mean, I really don't know. At the end of the day, I feel like it's one of those things as if you're winning, you're winning, and these tricks don't work like they used to.
Yeah, and I'm sure this happened to you before. The thing you don't want with your accounts is you play something and then it flies on the screen, like someone's betting it out. And I had one today. I was betting East Carolina over in college football, and it started moving. So then you're like, oh, you know, where did I bet this? And you know, I've had this account for 3 years. Like, I doubt it was this account. And I bet DraftKings. Like, I don't know. You know, you have to be aware of that too, which I'm sure you know.
I'm loving this conversation because it's very real, and it's stuff that we deal with regularly. But there's nothing worse than the wild goose chase of like trying to figure out which account set off the screen, just in general. And I've had times where I bet into like casino accounts from some degenerate who like is a losing bettor in the long run, and somehow the screen ends up moving. I'm like, how is this even possible? And you know, you pull your hair out for weeks trying to figure it out. But that's kind of like, while it's an absolute nuisance and you'd hope that it never happens, it kind of makes the experience like, I don't know what the word is, but like, you feel like you're living when that kind of stuff happens. You know what I'm saying?
And those, the best accounts to get are the ones that are like, oh, this guy finally quit. He dropped $50,000 over the past 3 months. Like, it's wide open, everything. Like, that's like my dream, but it doesn't happen too often.
The with the offshore accounts and some of the regulated books where they do have more automated trading teams, I think, you know, betting those not to the full limits, who knows? Like, I feel you there. You're like, oh, well, is this doing anything? I don't know, but I'm going to try it. And then if that one account lasts longer, then you're going to be like, oh, I'm doing this for everyone. But you know what I mean? It's the Wild West. You don't even know what's going on. I think the key is, if a manual review gets triggered on that account and somebody has to review it in a human goes in and looks, most likely you're toast anyways. So it's just about, you know, not hitting off the automated triggers that are going to say, oh, this guy's betting only Wong teasers, like, you know, flag a review, or this guy's betting only this. As long as you can, you know, take off those automated reviews, that's probably your best bet.
And that's, I had that, those are the ones I really try on, because you'll try to bet 550 and it'll say $267.50 is approved. Send the rest in for manual approval. I'll exit out of that. I'll just go back in and I'll bet like, whatever, 240 or whatever. It's just something, you know, 20 bucks below the limit where it doesn't get sent along to anybody. I have no idea if it helps, but I figure it can't hurt.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Like, I've been in the war room, so to speak, for a prominent offshore on a Super Bowl Sunday. So I've been able to see how they trade in real time. I think a lot of people give these books way more credit than they deserve in terms of like being able to flag winning bettors. And like, there's obviously certain books, which I'm not going to name, where it's like, if you have a pulse and you've won two bets in a row, you're going to get limited. And that's, but there's other books that are kind of willing to take a bet over time. But you see, like, I'm in a room for Super Bowl Sunday. I'm looking at a props trader who is basically looking, has to scroll down this massive list to see what the liabilities are on every individual prop. No automated alerts for big bets or anything of that nature. And that was kind of like, this was 4 or 5 years ago. And I'm like, why am I taking all these precautions? Like, look at the technology these guys are dealing with right now. Like, I can maybe just be betting it. So sometimes I wonder if I'm way too conservative in my approach. And I'm like, I don't really want to flag this or trigger some automated message to a trader that's going to get me banned, when I'm potentially leaving some massive EV on the table by doing that. I think I that's something I kind of learned over the year. I'm still not aggressive enough, because there's always that fear of like, this is a good shop for me and I don't want to get limited. But I wonder if you ever think the same thing, Mike, where you're just like, you know what, this is a big edge. I should just keep exploiting this and hopefully it flies under the radar for long enough for me to capitalize enough.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's the philosophy that you're going to get limited everywhere, so just attack. And then there's also the philosophy, like, do you bleed them slower and hopefully it's more? And I don't think either approach is wrong. It's probably dependent on the book, honestly, at least to a certain degree. It's also harder to find stuff where you can't, I mean, it's harder to just be able to full out attack and crush somebody right away, unless you're doing it with extremely easy stuff. So, which again is, like you said, a big red flag. So yeah, I don't have a philosophy either way. I think I've probably done both. I think I prefer to just win. So I guess I would rather just attack and win and move on.
Yeah. I mean, like if I get a new Buckeye account, for example, with large credit, the first thing I'm going to do is going to bet like 5 NFL games into it on the Sunday, just because I want to try to preserve this. And I want to create this image that whoever's betting into this account has no idea what they're doing. And I'm like, you know, I constantly think to myself after I place these bets, I'm like, this is minus EV. should I even do this? Like, is this actually making a difference? Is there an agent that's actually looking at these bets? The reality is we don't know, right? So we have, and that's the nature of this business. Sometimes you just got to take educated guesses. But that's the kind of stuff that really tears me up as a bettor, is not being able to quantify a specific edge or come up with an EV because there's so much of an unknown.
And any bookie who knows what they're doing after they see your stuff and the lines move in your favor, your lifespan's going to be short anyways. So it's hard to find bookies who don't know what they're doing that are bankrolled enough to be able to pay you. So it's this struggle all the time to find the dream bookie that just has endless cash that doesn't really care.
well, Mike, you mentioned also playing, like, unless you got easy stuff, you said, like, I'm sure you're referring to like smaller market stuff, but in reality, I think the definition of easy stuff is not what it used to be even like a year or two or three ago. And we'll keep saying this, obviously it gets harder every year, but I don't think anything exists right now in its current form where you're ripping off, like, you know, 30% edges on anything long term. So even if you're playing the smallest of markets or the smallest of prop markets, like, your edge is going to be something in the range of, like, you know, 10 to 30%. You're not going to have something where it's like free money, because even with a 30% edge, you know, depending on how much you're getting down, a 30% edge, one bet a week, two bets, like even one bet a day, you're going to have losing weeks still. So there's no guarantees right now in sports betting where you're ripping off like 60% edges and you're getting 10 bets a day. And like it's almost, you know, statistically impossible to have a losing week, you know?
Right. And like back in the early to mid 2000s, you know, the 2005 to 2010 range, there was that with like props. And like I've mentioned it before, like hockey props used to be like the easiest thing on the planet. You could just bet every single under every night and you would win. And there was so much square money before the Unlawful Gambling Act, there was so much square money. They would let you take like a pretty decent chunk of money from them before they took any action. And then it kind of got to the point where, and this is like only betting props in this account, it got to the point where it was like, okay, we're gonna let you win like, I don't know, 10,000. And then it got to the point where if the first night you put in only props, like you were limited the following day. So it just like slowly dwindled. And, you know, I think that's one of the underrated things about that gaming act back in, I think it was 2006. It took so much square money out of the market. And now books were kind of forced to look at the people who were still playing, and what they were doing was under a bigger microscope rather than everybody's betting favorites and overs. And, you know, we have enough money to pay. We have enough money to pay this guy that's only betting props.
Mike, something interesting that you said earlier was around college football. It's early in the year. There might be a little bit more subjectivity in the market right now because of, I guess, the uncertainty with numbers. And this is something that's always fascinated me with originators in general. And it's something I've wrestled with originating sports for a long time, because you have certain guys who are just, I'm going to trust my number type of thing, right? I'm going to model this game. If I make it a 3-point spread and I'm getting 4.5, I'm going to bet it regardless. There's nothing you can do to this person to get them off of that number. Then there's the people who add in a subjective layer on top of it. And I think I've evolved personally as a bettor from the former to the latter. And I'm curious how much subjectivity goes into your plays, because you know, you're talking about what you're betting in college football and it not being the same volume as it was back in the day. How much of that is because of this layer of you saying, well, this doesn't seem right to me, I'm going to avoid it? Or maybe, you know, someone who I really respect in the market likes the other side, so I'm not going to play it type of thing.
So I always say, I always have this question to modelers. So is your goal when you're modeling, is your goal to be as close to the closing line as possible? Are you trying to create a model where an advantage is shown as more of an extreme advantage than it truly is?
That's a good question. Like for me personally, it's more about, I want to be on the right. I want to be able to predict the line movement more so than have the exact closing line, right? I just need it to be directionally correct.
I agree with you. So if I make a game minus 10 and the book's out at minus 3, that doesn't mean, because I'm a winning bettor, doesn't mean that line should be minus 10. The true line is somewhere in between those two numbers. And you know, I think people think when you're a professional that it means your number is the correct number. It's not. So you have to have that in mind when you're doing these things. So if I show a 7-point gap, which is pretty rare, I always say, like, when you get into the season far enough, like, I've said before, like, I used to model college football and I used to do very well at it. I used to beat almost every line. But all the sites I used are no longer in existence. So I actually hired someone this past summer and we're building a model together. So I'm kind of getting back more into the math, whereas I like to have the math at least as a basis. But I always say, like, if your model shows a 10-point gap in week 12 and there's not like injury related, or, and 12 would be a completely extreme example, of course. If you don't bet that, I say, what the hell's the point of having a model? Like, I feel like a gap like that, you have to bet it. Or if you don't believe in your model enough to bet on that, you shouldn't be using it in the first place. So where I would get more into the subjectivity is, and don't get me wrong, I would still look into that game and make sure that that number wasn't that number because of something out of the ordinary or injuries or whatever it may be, weather, you know, something crazy. But when you get into the 5-point gap, 7-point gap, I'm talking college football totals. If I'm going to show a 5 or 7-point gap, I'm going to look into that and I'm going to say, you know, what can I look at here to see if I'm going to determine if this is a play or not? And like early season, it's much easier. Like I mentioned the East Carolina game earlier. Marshall has a new coach this year. They're playing Marshall at Marshall. Marshall's playing really, really fast this year compared to last season. So there should be a lot of plays in that game. Marshall's defense probably isn't quite as good. I made the number last year, 55.5. It's 55 this year. So I feel like there's probably 15 more plays in last year's game. That might be a little high, 10 more plays in last year's game you would project. So that additional yardage, it just makes for an easy decision to bet a game like that. And that's kind of what I'm looking for is things along that line in the early season. Late season, I'm going to look at if something's way off, I might say like the Browns one year, it might've been last year, and I don't bet NFL, but this is just an example. Like the Browns played in bad weather, like four weeks in a row,
three weeks in a row. And then a couple weeks later, all their wide receivers had COVID. So they had no wide receivers.
So I felt like their totals were depressed because of playing in that weather for three straight weeks. So those are the type of things I would look at if I had a big gap, or those are the type of things that I would keep a mental note of if I'm watching games. And I don't watch a ton of games, but those type of things. Coaches saying things, or coaches changing a philosophical style, or you know, maybe just a matchup where this team just, you know, they defend the pass really well. They're going against a team that can't run, things like that. And that's built into my models. So
right,
that should be taken care of. But stuff like that. In early season, I'm going to be more dependent on that kind of thing in football. I'm basically totally dependent on that in early season in football. Basketball, college hoops, I'm pretty much all season long, I'm looking at matchups. And this basketball is so easy to make a number on. I just think looking at matchups and knowing how teams play against similar style teams, that's what I do. And it's mostly the small schools that nobody's ever heard of that I focus on.
Right. So you're looking for a differentiator, essentially. I mean, basketball, you're right. Like everybody's just projecting the amount of possessions each team is going to have in a game. They're looking at offensive, defensive efficiency. Like everybody's going to kind of arrive at the same number. So you kind of have to do something to differentiate yourself from market, or potentially gain like some sort of additional edge there.
Right. Right. And last year I didn't do a lot of math. I've alluded to this before, but like I don't have as much time as I used to have. I have three kids. I don't have the time in a day to spend that I used to. So you know, at one point last year, I would just, my one friend would call me and I would have nothing in front of me. And he would just say, I'm going to read you the games, tell me what you think the line should be. So we'd go through the entire card and then he would just note the games where it was more than a 5-point gap. And then those usually ended up being the games that, that we ended up betting on. So, and it was just from subjective analysis that I had in my head. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't betting all of them. If I'm more than 5 points off, and he said, oh, you're like 8 points off on this, I'd be like, oh, I screwed up that guess because of this, this, or this. So,
Mike, you betting a lot of futures or anything, you know, full season?
I don't like to tie up money that long. I usually bet WNBA futures where I can, which they had some win totals out like the day before the season started. I just happened to be at the casino, so I was able to bet that. I did bet college football win totals this year. I don't do a lot with NFL. I've had some really good college hoops tickets in the past and nothing's ever come through for me. I had Virginia the one year they were a one seed. I had them at 150-1.
Was that the year they got upset by the 16?
Michigan State in the Sweet 16.
Oh, okay. All right.
But so that was a really good ticket. I had at Auburn when they lost to Virginia a couple of years ago. I had them at between 70 and 100-1. A few other good ones, but I've never come through. It seems like a blue blood wins in college hoops every year, though. It's very rare to have any chance of winning those. So it is what it is.
Yeah. I want to talk about what you mentioned earlier and venturing into soccer a little bit, which is kind of unique. I don't really have a lot of people around me that wager on soccer regularly. Granted, it, you know, was mostly, you know, up until the last few years where MLS is starting to grow, especially in the US and Canada as well. There's not a lot of North American interest. But for me personally, I've always thought about soccer because, you know, you look at the amount you could get down on a soccer game and it's exciting for like, now there's obvious reasons why sportsbooks will take an amount on a soccer game. But for me, you're competing against probably the sharpest bettors in the world and syndicates of like 40 quants and even more than that, who are just like have access to unlimited data and basically can do like whatever they want to come up with a number, tons of money behind these. And that's why I'm really interested in your venture into soccer, but I'm also interested in like, how do you gain an edge in a sport where you're competing against that type of brain power?
I don't do any soccer personally. So this is all, my brother does it. He's been doing it for a long time. So it's not necessarily a new thing for us. He's just always been an MLS fan, and the MLS market, I almost feel like we have it to ourselves. I don't feel like lines tend to move when lineups come out. If a major guy is not in a starting lineup, a line will move, and they don't seem to have done that well this year. Or last year, really. I think it was last year. It wasn't very good. But most of it is just, and my brother's not a math guy. This is mostly subjective. He's watching every single game. Like, there's an MLS live package. You can watch it whenever you want. So he's watching every single game. I think you get, even if you're not a math guy, you kind of get a sense. This line should be 2.5 when these two teams play. This should be 3 juiced over. You get a sense for that whether you're a math guy or not, if you're good enough at it. So that's kind of where it goes. And it's just, you know, MLS isn't like a high profile league worldwide by any stretch. So right. I don't feel like I'm competing against any of these groups that you're talking about. It doesn't appear that I am, at least. There's international friendlies and the three best players on one team will be out. I mean, Seattle this year had like 7 starters out the one game. Of course, we bet against them at lost. But it had like 7 guys out and the line, it's adjusted, but not enough. And so it's not a math thing. I mean, you'd approach it from a completely analytical angle. We're approaching it, or I'm not approaching it anyway. I'm just betting it. But he's approaching it from a totally subjective angle. And, you know, I think he's been doing it 8 or 9 years. Like I said, this has been his worst year. He had one other season where he lost like 2 units. And other than that, I think he's averaged, if I don't know, but I would guess 15 units a season. So, nice. I mean, that's decent supplemental income, and it's not that hard. Some of the off screens have it a ton of vig in it and juiced heavily, but in general, like it's not too bad to get down, and it doesn't really move, and it's been a good thing long term. So
yeah, you've essentially found a market that a lot of professionals are not focusing their attention on. It's kind of like where I found my edge in NHL 5 years ago, right? It's like, you know, the starting goalie is changed to a backup who should be priced. I don't want to speak in terms of cents, or we could do percentage points, but this guy's significantly worse and the line is not moving here. Like, what are we doing, people? Now, it's not like that in the NHL anymore. But yeah, I felt for a long time like I'm just betting into a market that nobody else is paying attention to. And because of that, I have a significant edge.
I tried hockey before. I tried hockey at one point. This is probably 8 years ago. And I made this model, and I don't have the computer skills to do player level stuff, which I think is a major hindrance at this point. Maybe I thought it was worthwhile 8 years ago, but I remember building the model and I backtested it, and I backtested one season first. I was plus like 45 units. I was like, holy hell, like this is good. And then I backtested the previous two seasons and it was like minus 63 units combined. So I was like, back to the drawing board here. So I kind of gave up on hockey. I've always been better at the point spread sports than the money line sports for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, everybody has the things that work for them and things that don't. And sometimes it just gets in your head as well, where if you subjectively feel like you're better at certain things, but from like a mathematical perspective, it doesn't even make sense. It's just all randomness. Like, a lot of times we just get carried away with these small samples and we're like, I always seem to lose when I bet on, you know, home teams in this league. And it's like a dozen bets. But that's like, and I know I actually heard you talk about this on Ed Fang's podcast before, which actually people should check out. I'll give it a plug as well, because I think Ed does a great job with his podcast. But you talked about hating losing just in general and kind of getting into these spirals where you just, you know, people are tailing you, you're working with a partner, and just absolutely hating that side of things to the point where it affects your mental capacity in some state. And I've been there, and we talked to Rufus a couple weeks ago, and he's been there before. And I wonder if that's something that has improved for you over time. If there's anything that you do on a personal level to get around that, just kind of take us through that experience when you're going through a losing stretch.
I think when you start and you go through losing streaks, it's different. And then, but when this becomes like a job and there's an expectation that you're going to win money, it sort of takes the fun out of it, I guess, a little bit. When there's that expectation of winning, not all the time, but winning more than you're losing. So losing streaks, I think, become difficult to handle. And I know that it's part of it, and I have the personality type generally to handle it pretty well. I'm laid back. I don't drive a nice car or anything. Like I just like to gamble. deep down, I'm just like a degenerate that happened to be smart enough to figure out how to win at certain things. So, but the losing for me was worse for me. Like when I worked at Raz, I remember I always ran pretty well at Raz. There was one season that I worked there where the service was down. And I was down slightly as well. But I remember having like, I ran pretty well when I first started there. And I remember having like an 0-5 day and being like, oh my, like, Ed's gonna think I'm a jackass. And he's like, don't worry about it. Like everybody, it happens to everybody. But I was so green and new, I felt like it was making me look stupid. But when I would really feel bad about it, after I worked with that, I went to Sports Insights and I did their picks for a couple of years. And I had one really bad college football season. And I lost more sleep over that than anything in my life. I just couldn't. And you know, one of the hard parts about selling picks or giving picks out is when I was at Sports Insight, I wanted to wait until later in the week to release because I knew it wasn't like a clientele like Raz's. It was a square clientele where I didn't know if they had the outlets to bet early or whatever. So I thought I should release it later in the week. So I can't remember if I was releasing on Wednesday night or Thursday. But at the beginning of the week, like you have 10 bets and five of them, the market moves your way and five of them are pretty stagnant and don't move much. So when it comes time to release, do you release the five that have moved your way or do you release the five that haven't moved at all? And apparently that year I did a really shitty job of determining what to release because I had a decent year betting, but I'm giving out just loser after loser after loser. I think I had like a 5 week span, 4 week span maybe where I was like 5-16 or something. And I felt horrible. Like I feel horrible about that. It's one thing for me to lose money, but like when you know that someone's paying for like, I'm getting paid to provide these terrible picks. So I felt like Dan Fabrizio's paying me money. And I like at one point, like, there was some confusion with an account, like where I was supposed to get the money sent to. And I didn't even want to ask Dan for the money. I'm like, I'm getting absolutely crushed. And now I got to ask this guy to pay me. Like it was like embarrassing. So it's more I think that's the hard part of putting picks out there is the and you mentioned it on Twitter, the negativity and all that comes along with, and I think Rufus felt when he was on ESPN for those, he wasn't on very long, I don't think, but I think he just had a bad run of picks. And yep. I know that it ate at him, and because we all have egos as sports bettors. Like who? I remember taking a tour of a sports book in a major sports book, just like you said, in Costa Rica, and he's like, "Well, this is the room where all our modelers are," and I'm like, "I'm one person, and I'm trying to beat like these 18 people that are going to be sitting there. Like, right. You have to have an ego to some degree to be able to think you can do that." So it's humbling when you go on these losing streaks. And I think it's more of the money, you know, you'll have days where you'll make it back eventually. You know, I the worst day I ever had in college football, I remember we were like, this is in October. I don't know what year, 2015, maybe, 2013. I don't know, several years ago, but, I just remember we were like, 3-15 or something, and we had like 6 night games. And I said to my partner, I'm like, you know, maybe we'll go 6-0 on these and this will turn around. We went 0-6. I mean, we were like, yeah. And we always say, like, we're never going to mention that day again. But, you know, over the next 3 weeks, we actually made all the money back from that day. So you have to have the bankroll to make it through that. And you have to be disciplined enough to not be betting like an idiot where you're overextending yourself. Because if you do have the edge, eventually you're going to make that up. And it's just it's a short-term glitch. It's variance. And it happens to everybody.
Yeah. Just as I mentioned earlier, even in this podcast, with the small percentage edge that you might have, like there's going to be losing weeks, there's going to be losing months, unless you're at a volume, you know, spread so far across that, you know, you're reducing your variance. You're going to have a losing month. And it's so painful sometimes. But at the end of the day, you just have to remember, like, listen, I got crushed. It happens. It's happened before. It'll happen again. Let's move on long term. You know, let me focus on the things that are going to make money and continue to do so. And it sucks. I completely feel you. The one thing where I guess we don't differ is like in the pick selling thing, where if it's like, yeah, anyone could lose their own money, but when you lose someone else's money, I can only imagine how bad that would feel when you're already in the dumps that day for losing your own money, and now you're dealing with, you know, additional stress and additional things that are, you know, going through your head.
Yeah, and that's why I actually, you know, when I was on Ed's podcast, he asked me about Twitter. I was looking just in case you guys asked me. I actually had a Twitter back in the day. I totally forgot about it, but I had a Twitter, and I looked at it last night, and my last post was exactly 12 years ago tomorrow. So, wow. Yeah.
Mike Craig, 69, 69, 69 on Twitter for those who want to follow.
Do you remember the book Cascade?
Honestly, Mike, I don't read. Like unless it's going to help me get better at a skill, I don't read.
So Bet Cascade, there's a guy that ran, his name was Lenny.
Wait, he means the sports book, Rob.
I'm so out of it right now that I'm like, what's this guy asking me about for a book? No, I don't remember Cascade. That's well before my time.
Rob just outed himself. Rob just dated
myself
books.
So hard,
and he just admitted to everyone he's not an intellect. He doesn't read books.
But there was an account at Cascade, and ended up stiffing a bunch of people, and I had a lot of money in there at the time for me. And I ended up talking to the owner, this Lenny guy, and he was like, "Well, just email my personal email." And I said, "Okay, give it to me." He was like, "It's Lenny6969@hotmail.com." Something like that. I hope I didn't just give out a
69420@hotmail.com.
right. You got to have a 420 in there too.
That's the classic. Okay. I'm Mike, you know, you went from handing out parlay cards in high school to, you know, bonus hunting. Like how do you get involved with Right Angle Sports? Cause obviously a huge service. Was there pre-existing relationships you might've had with Ed or anyone else there? Were you discovered? How did that all come about?
So I had no pre-existing relationships. So, you know, back to the Dr. Bob stuff. So Dr. Bob, when I was subscribing to Dr. Bob, he was only giving out sides, but he was giving out score projections for every game. So I mentioned before, I was betting for a big group of people, like all my bonus fours, like were giving me money. And so I was putting in bets, and I started to just use Bob's score projections to bet totals. So so every week I would say, here's our totals. And we were killing it on that stuff. So at the bottom of my email, I would sign it, Mike, King of College Totals, Craig. And so I went on the RX. It was an old form, it's still around, the RX. So I went on the RX, and I'm very uncreative with everything. So I'm like, I don't know what the hell to call myself. Like, so I call myself King of College Total. And I just started posting like WNBA. I started 1 year. It was either 17-2 or 19-2. I started 1 year in WNBA back when it was simple. And I was also posting like score projections for college hoops games based on the stuff I was doing at KenPom, which in hindsight, if someone did that today, I'd be so pissed off. But I didn't know. I didn't realize I was ruining anything for anybody. So I think Ed messaged me. Well, I know Ed messaged me on the RX, but for some reason, like I didn't log into the RX for like a month. So I actually went in, I logged into, this is probably 2000, I think this is 2008 or nine. I think it was nine. 2009, like early in the year. So I'm not on the RX for like a month or two. And I go in and I log in and I have a private message. It's from Edward and it's like a month old. And I'm like, oh shit, you gotta be kidding me. Like I post all this stuff to get like a break like this. And now I've blown it. So I message him back. I'm like, man, I'm sorry. I haven't logged in here in a while. Like I'm super interested in possibly, and he said, you know, looking to get better at math at RAS, looking to have more of a math spin on things and have better numbers, impressed with what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. So I messaged him back and I said, yeah, you know, I'm super interested. And we came to an agreement and I started in on college. I didn't do WNBA that year with them. I started in for the college hoop season. And basically we had a shared Google document and I was just putting score projections in there. And then I and the payment structure was I got a free roll on every RAS play. I got a small amount of guaranteed money for providing numbers. And then I could submit plays to him that I thought should be releases with a write up. And then he would filter those. And if he chose to release anything, he would release it. So, I remember talking to him when I started and I had a job at the time and I was like, I'm just going to quit my job because like, this is what I really want to do. And he was like, no, don't do that. So I praise him for being honest up front and, you know, him probably thinking I'll, you know, this guy, I'm taking a shot on him and we'll see where this goes. But, I ended up and I started out very well there. I gave myself a cushion at the beginning where I hit, I don't remember what percentages I hit, but I'm sure for the season, this is college hoops totals 12 years ago, so it wasn't rocket science. But I started out very well and ended up, I don't remember what I ended up for the season, but I know that I And we were talking about it. You met Mike from Raz at Bet Bash. And I got like my first little stack of money from him. That was my first stack of cash I got. I'd withdrawn before, but it had always gone into it went in a net teller and sites like that. I had never like gotten a stack of cash. So that was my first stack of cash I got. And yeah, so that's how I got started there. And that's what I was doing. And then I left in January of 2013, and I actually didn't leave on the best of terms. And that's one thing I always regret. I just was kind of, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if it wasn't for Edward and the chance I got there. So I'm very grateful for him taking a chance on me. But you know, I think there was just a breakdown of communication, and there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes. And it wasn't just Mike and myself and Ed. There were some other people involved. At one point, like, I was on the website. So there was Mike Raz, who was the one you met. And then I was Craig Raz. I was actually listed as a partner on the site. But I kind of got frustrated because you sort of outgrow your a free roll type of situation. Like when you have a job like that, or when you're getting paid like to do that, part of that is, you know, tell me what you like, but then you can't fully bet that. I can't hit the screen because I can't move the line. So it sort of became a hindrance of, of bankroll growth. And I don't know what was better, getting paid by Ed or betting on my own. But, I guess it kind of went wrong with, I felt like I wanted to be working with Ed and not for him. And I always felt like I was working for him, despite the fact that I was like listed on the website and everything. And in hindsight, and I should have just communicated that to him. Yep. But what ended up happening is some of the other guys within Raz, we started talking a little more and doing some betting. And, you know, I thought I should have been privy to more of the Raz information. Like, I didn't know what the releases were. I got a free roll on the place, but I didn't know what the releases were going to be ahead of time. And Ed, at the time, Ed was always very guarded and didn't really trust anyone. And I didn't really get that at the time. And, you know, as I get older and you deal with people stiffing you and you find out how people really are in this business, it makes more sense as you look back as to why he wasn't fully open. So, you know, I think there was just a breakdown of communication, and a couple of the guys left the team. I ended up staying on in 2012, and I was doing football at that time, college football at that time with him too. And I don't know that he trusted my stuff at that point, because that was really the year that I sort of figured it out. But I had a really good year in football that year. 2012 was actually my best year I've ever had overall. I had like a week. I just looked last night just to prepare for this podcast. And I had like a 22-week stretch where I won 20 weeks. And the two losing weeks were like down barely anything. So I had a really good year that year. I mean, in college, that's the year I think I was probably Raz's best year. I wrote down the record here. Raz that year, we ran, it was just sides only. There wasn't totals that year or widely available totals in that year. I think it was just the TV games. But Raz was 90-52 that year.
Holy jeez.
63.4%. And
variance working in your favor, the randomness working in your favor that year.
Yeah. And like my stuff that year was 69-44. So I had a really good
Craig 69.
Right, there you go. So I had a really good year that year. I think my football record that year, I think they only did 8 weeks. I think I was 35-24. I couldn't find that, but that sticks in my head. So almost 60% in that. So I had a really good year. And at the end of that year, I think Ed still had some hard feelings from what had happened in the past. And I had barely any communication with them that year. So we just kind of, at the end of that, at the beginning of 2013, just kind of went, well, I went my separate way. He stayed the course with his stuff, of course. So, but yeah, I always regret how that went down, because I am, I am grateful for that opportunity, and I miss talking. I still chat with that.
So much. Yeah, that's what I was gonna like. Has the relationship been amended? Are you guys on good terms now?
Yeah, I think Ed's more introverted than I am. I'm introverted. You probably don't know that because I'm
no. Because every time I see you, you're drinking a beer and you're very jovial about it. Yeah,
I'm alcohol induced extroverted when I'm around you. But I'm generally a pretty introverted guy. Like, I don't like to leave my house. I don't like talking to that many people. And so Ed and I were similar in that way. We've talked a few times. I definitely think we're cordial with each other. I really like Mike from Raz. I hadn't seen him. We hung out the night before Bet Bash. We hung out in New Jersey at a mutual friend's beach house. It was awesome. Had a really good time with them. But it's always, I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, it's the nice thing about going to Boston for MIT or going to something like Bet Bash. Like, you probably don't have people in your normal everyday life that you can converse with and that can relate to the things that you do on a daily basis. So I think, you know, I just miss the interaction, and I wish it was more when I was there. And, you know, I don't know what the future holds for Raz. I don't know if he's going to do the service forever or, you know, I don't know what his team's like now. I will say I do get insulted when he says this is the best team they've ever had. Because I want to feel like that the couple of years we had together, like, we had a pretty damn good team. So don't get me wrong, I know Jeff. I don't know him. I met him and hung out with him one time in Vegas when we were both there. When he was, I think I probably was still with Raz, but he's a really nice guy, sharp guy. So I had nothing but good things to say about those guys. Yeah, I think it was time for me to move on. I just wish I would have done it in a more amicable fashion, so to speak.
It's very honest of you. Nice for you to air it all out there, because, that's just an interesting story. And I don't think that's been discussed or in a public forum before. So really appreciate the honesty, Mike. Yeah. And I mean, I hope that you and Ed end up on great terms, because I talk to Ed pretty frequently. I've never met him in person before, but I think he's a great guy just in general. I like you both. So I just hope that relationship is, you know, doesn't deteriorate.
No, we're not in a bad spot. I mean, we still chat back and forth, and especially like if I'm losing, I'll be like, hey, you know, are you guys like at the beginning of this WNBA season? Like, first thing I asked Mike when I saw him, I'm like, hey, are you like losing all your big bets at the beginning of the season? He was like, yeah, we were. So you know, it's nice to know that you were on the similar stuff at least when you're going through a losing streak and you weren't just misreading the entire market or anything. So but I don't think we're on bad terms at this point. I don't want to portray it like that. I just wish it would have ended a little better. And I think all that needed to happen is better communication. So that's a lot on me. So
Mike, I'm going to ask you a question that wasn't on the, I sent you an outline before we did the podcast. I purposely didn't put it on there because I wanted to get a spontaneous reaction from you, but we talked about a hypothetical with Preston last week. And I'll ask you the same question because I think this is fascinating just to hear different people's answers. And we've heard all sorts of different answers in regards to this question, especially those who listened to the podcast last week, messaged the BetStamp account, messaged me personally just in general. But let's say, hypothetically, you have a coin flip to win $1 billion, 1 billion. So your EV on that coin flip is $500 million. What would I have to pay you? What amount of money would you accept to sell me that coin flip?
So I'm thinking about my answer more. And I would take less than the EV amount, because it would be life-changing money. I mean, 10 million would be life-changing money. Plus, I think 5 million would be life-changing. 1 million would be life-changing. I think... you could take that money and invest it. So I wouldn't say 500,000 or 500 million.
Right.
I would say it would be, man, 10
What's
million.
What's the lowest absolute
10 million. It seems like I'm giving up so much EV to take 10 million.
Right. But the thing is, if I put that $10 million briefcase in front of you, right, just with the cash, like, there's not a lot of people that are turning that down, even though there's a chance of a billion. It's a tough one.
I think the gambler in you wants to say more than what your heart is going to say. So I think I'm probably, it's probably a dumb answer, but I think I'm in the 5 to 10 million range.
All right. I mean, that's a fair answer, and it's not uncommon either. I mean, the true, I don't want to say degenerate answer, but like the true gambler's answer is, I'm not selling the flip. I'm going to flip the coin, right? I'll take my 500 million EV. That's the true gambler's answer, which is like, I'm not even asking for 500 million for the flip. I'm going to flip the coin.
Like, I didn't give my answer last week. I want to give my rationale behind this, because I really do like this question. I think for me, there's only three acceptable answers. Now, I don't mean to be judgy or whatever, but I think there's only three acceptable answers, and I'll break them down into buckets for everybody. Okay. So acceptable answer one is for somebody who approaches this question and says, I'm struggling right now. Money is very important to me and will help change my life. And getting some amount of money is going to be super valuable. And in which case, I don't care about the EV at all. I just want some money that's going to help me out. And I think for 99% of the world, they should be willing to take something in the range of $20,000 to $100,000 in order to help them. So, you know, a 50-50 shot at a billion obviously is awesome, but having an extra 100,000 that can get you out of debt and get you, you know, off the street, so to say, I think that is an acceptable answer for a lot of people. And I would say it's a good answer. Okay. Second, you have kind of the same mentality that Rob said, which was, you know, listen, I have a good job. I like what I'm doing. I'm not on the street. I could feed my wife, my kids, whatever. But the reality is, I would like to, you know, retire, be set for life, do whatever I want for life. In which case, Rob's answer, and I'll challenge him right now, because I think he said something like 25 million. I think that's not even an acceptable answer, because if you want to be set for life, 25 mil, there's no instance in which that could be your walk away. Because if you're willing to accept 25 mil, then you're also willing to accept 24 mil, and then also probably 23, 22, 21. So I'd say, you know, $1 million to $10 million, whatever your actual walk away would be, that you're saying, if I get this money, I'm set for life, I'm good, and I'm going to enjoy that. And then there's the third train of thought, which is $1 billion can help change the world. $1 billion can do anything. It's not about being set for life. It's not about being financially free. It's about getting to a spot where, you know, you could do real things with that money. And in that scenario, I think the acceptable answer is, you say, I'm flipping unless you give me above my expected value. Because at some point, you know, like if someone offered me 750 million and I'm flipping, like it just doesn't make sense for me to not take the expected value bridge. So I'd say I lean more towards that last answer, where I would kind of want to flip it, to be honest. But at the same time, I do appreciate those other two answers. So Mike, what you said, I think is like very acceptable, in a sense where you're like, listen, that's life-changing money. I'm gonna be set for life. I'm gonna do what I want. Like, I'll take somewhere in that range. I think that's, you know, a really good answer.
And are you trying to change the world?
This podcast is not about that. I'm not going to go into like ambition and stuff like that. And, you know, I don't have a plan of how I'd change the world with a
billion
dollars.
Mike, he just wants to say that he's a billionaire. That's all he wants to say.
No, it's not even about that. If I wanted to be a billionaire, I would accept like 300, I would accept 400 million or 300 million, right? Because you could invest that, and you'll become a billionaire anyways. I just think, and listen, at the end of the day, all of this I'm saying is a hypothetical. No one will ever have this opportunity. It's just a made up question to get people thinking. And at the end of the day, like if someone, like Rob said, like if you're there and I'm about to flip that coin and someone's like, here's $100 million in a briefcase. Yeah. Right. Like, am I turning that down? I would like to think that I am turning it down and I'm going to flip, but am I, you know, you'll never know unless you're actually in that scenario with the money on the table, with the coin in your hand, and you have to make the decision.
I think the hypothetical numbers are always high because it's a hypothetical. And when presented that in a real life situation, your number is going to come down. Like for me, yeah, 25 million. You're right, Johnny. Like if I'm at the bargaining table, I say, I want 25 million. And someone's like, well, I'll give you 10. Like my natural inclination is going to be like, I'm not going to do it for 10, but I'll do it for 20. And they're like, no, I'm offering you 10. I'm going to be like, okay, done deal. I'm taking the 10. Like that's what's going to happen. And I think that like we've heard it. We went to dinner at Tao in New York where we were some other pro gamblers who are like, I do it for 450 million because, you know, I can't deal with giving up so much EV. It's like bullshit. You're doing it for 450 million. Like you're telling me if someone didn't come up, bring that number down to 100 or had $100 million on a table, you're not going to take it. Like out of principle, you're going to flip that coin. There's no chance. So,
well, cause that's the thing on the mentality. Like if you're willing to take a cut on EV and accept 450 million, then there's almost no scenario in which you wouldn't accept 449 million.
Yeah.
Right. I agree totally with what you're saying. If you take 25, you're going to take 20.
Yeah. There's a point where EV just, it doesn't matter anymore. Like I understand, I'm a big math guy in general. I completely understand. Like if we did this same coin toss with it being a chance to win $100, then the numbers are going to be very different. Right? Because I'm not taking anything less than $50 because that money doesn't matter to me. But you get to a point where the money no longer, like the difference to me between 10 million and 25, while there is definitely a difference between $15 million, it's not as big as one would think. There's not a whole lot more that I can do.
Right. And I feel like if you got $500,000, that's not enough to set up your kids and for the rest of their lives. I mean, shit, that's barely enough to pay for college now. So like, I feel like it's gotta be more than that. I feel like it's gotta be seven figures.
Yeah.
Has to be.
You know what, Mike, you're a true stand-up guy because the first thing you thought of was setting up your kids for the rest of their lives. And that's like, that's a class act right there. Mike Craig, even though you have 69, 69, 69 at the end of your Twitter, you're still a class act.
Thank you.
We're going to ask you the closing question. We ask this to every guest. We've got a variety of different answers. It's always interesting to gain some perspective or just their general thoughts. But Mike Craig, if you could go back 5 years, talk to a previous version of yourself, what piece of advice would you give your old self?
From a gambling perspective or from a life perspective?
You know what? We haven't really been asked that, I guess.
Up to you. Dealer's choice.
Dealer's choice, yeah.
Well, from a gambling perspective, 5 years, I think I'd tell myself to get paid out in Bitcoin rather than cash. So from a gambling philosophy standpoint, I feel like my growth was more prior to 2016. If I could go back further than that, it would be have more confidence in yourself, bet more, bet the bigger edges more, instead of, I tended to flat bet, I guess, a little bit. Not completely flat bet, but too flat. So I would vary my bet sizes more. I bet more parlays when I had a big edge. I would accumulate Bitcoin, and that's pretty much it. I guess, you know, we talked about the Raz thing. I guess from that perspective, I've always kind of prided myself in being able to look at things from a long-term perspective and not think about short-term. And I think I probably lost sight of that a little bit in that situation. So I would probably, from a life perspective, probably go back and tell myself, like, think about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, don't just think about right now. I don't know. Don't be so hard on yourself when losing streaks. Things like that. I think, Yeah, I think that's probably about it.
That's a great answer. I mean, we asked for one piece of advice. You gave us like about a dozen. So, I mean, I'm just joking around. But
I think three or four people have said get paid out in Bitcoin.
Everybody regrets not getting in.
Well, the funny thing is about Bitcoin, like anybody who bought it at $100 or $200 probably has none of it now. Or anybody who bought it $3,000 probably has none of it now. So it's kind of this thing where everybody regrets it. And I had some and I got hacked and then I got rid of it. So, or most of it. So, yeah, but it's easy to second guess this kind of things. I wish I had Ethereum. I was more a believer in Ethereum than Bitcoin actually. And it was so cheap. And I always looked at the ratio of Bitcoin to Ethereum and I just kick it when Bitcoin goes up to 50 and Ethereum's still at $200. I'm like, well, why didn't I buy like a lot of this?
You know what's really funny, Mike, is I have a feeling like 10 years from now, we're still going to be going to Sloan or some conference and we're going to be meeting up and we're going to be having this exact same conversation. And we're going to be like, why did we not buy Ethereum when it was like $3,000 or Bitcoin at, you know, 45,000 or whatever, right? That's just kind of the way it's been going.
We'll be talking about millibitcoins at that point, right? MBCs and yeah.
We can hope. Yeah, Mike, do you have anything to promote? I mean, I don't think you do. Like, I can't even hand out normally I'd end this podcast with giving out the guest Twitter handle or whatever. Like, where can people find you? I guess they can't.
My Twitter handle, since I'm completely unoriginal, my Twitter handle is just MJC257. And I guess maybe I'll probably post for 2 weeks on it and then never post again. But I'm logged into my phone there. So I suppose if anybody would want to private message me on there, it's MJC257. That was my Penn State student ID.
All right. Let's get Mike Craig some followers on Twitter at MJC257. Really appreciate the time, Mike. Thanks.
Wait,
for
I just went
us
to his Twitter, by the way. His last tweet, he said my last tweet was what do you say, 12 years ago? It is, first off. It's actually 12 years ago tomorrow. He gave out a pick. Seattle and Los Angeles Sparks, WNBA total, under 137. He also likes Atlanta over Detroit, series price at -125 or so. We got to go back. Someone's got to go back and see if those won 12 years ago.
So 2009 LA Sparks season, that's what we're looking at right now?
Yeah, there's a few picks. It probably lost. Johnny, how old are you? Were you like, you were definitely a teenager when that was posted, right?
Back in that, yeah, definitely was, man, who knows if I think by that point I probably placed like, maybe I haven't even placed a bet yet, who knows.
I can't even find like a game log for the 2009 WNBA season. It's like this doesn't even exist. That's how long ago it was. We definitely have to find out if that won. And if it didn't, I'm definitely replying to that tweet, Mike, calling you a loser.
Trap my record on there. I'll get all kind of hate. And Rob, I let me give you a plug, too. This is a true story. So I've had a few people, like the guy who is working on football models for me and some basketball stuff, too. And there's been a couple other people that have asked me. But a couple people have asked me, like, is there any podcast I can listen to where I could learn just in general? And I always say, I don't necessarily say this pod. I don't say Circles Off. I say find a podcast that Rob Pozzolo is on where he's getting questioned about modeling, because I align with you. I don't know that you've ever spoken a word about modeling that I haven't agreed with. So I have a ton of respect for your origination abilities.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate that you're not promoting Johnny to your friends as well, and instead sending them my way, which is nice, because we don't want him to have too big of an ego and flip that $1 billion coin. But really appreciate your time, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Johnny.
All right. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you.